Good morning. The vice presidential debate happens tonight. Is there much more at stake than in other years when VP candidates face each other and the American public? The political junkie Ken Rudin weighs in later this hour. Meanwhile, little fire ants are causing pet owners on Hawaii Island great concern. Some say it's more than just cloudy eyes, but it could mean partial blindness. Animal advocate Sid Singer of the Good Shepherd Foundation joins us this morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergood. It's an interdisciplinary conference at UH Manoa that encourages academics and artists alike to engage with Vietnam through scholarship and the arts. And on Maui, the Valley Owl Kennel Club is holding a dog rally along with obedience classes. All breeds are welcome, and your dog is never too old to learn new tricks.
It's dogs, it's cats, it's politics, and a whole lot more for this Tuesday, October 4th on The Conversation. Now news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We seem to be focusing on companion animals quite a bit this morning.
We are, and unfortunately a companion to some of the animals that are highly unwanted. Now,
yeah.
You know that in Puna, many pet owners are fearing for their four-legged companions. The stings from little fire ants, an invasive species, are being blamed for partial blindness and cloudy eyes in dogs and cats. Most of the information is anecdotal. There is yet to be a study proving conclusively that the little fire ants cause blindness. The condition, though, is called tropical keratopathy, and pet owners aren't waiting for the research. They're holding a community meeting tomorrow night to look at what can be done now to save other pets on Hawaii Island's east side. Sid Singer is the director of the Good Shepherd Foundation. He joins us by phone now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you. Certainly for any pet owner who sees anything wrong with his or her pet, it can be devastating. The fact that we don't have conclusive proof with the ants and their stings and possible blindness to animals seems to be not quite the point, although clearly you believe that there is a link between the two.
Yeah, there does seem to be a link. There was a study done in Tahiti that found, a correlation between the appearance of the ants, and they have a big fire ant problem there too, and the incidence of this clouding of the eyes. But in any event, we need to help the animals. I mean, getting rid of the ants is really not an option anymore on the Big Island, according to the Hawaii Ant Lab, which is sort of having to learn how to deal with them. And one of the, if this is a problem caused by the ants, which it seems certainly to be associated, then we still need a strategy for dealing with this eye problem, which is like a lifelong problem for these animals and can lead to partial and even total blindness.
You make a good point that correlation doesn't necessarily mean causality, but it doesn't really matter if you have animals who are at risk and people who obviously love their animals. So we know it's not just on Hawaii Island. There are little fire ants on Oahu, too. We don't seem to be seeing the same prevalence of the problems with animals over here. Why is that?
Well, I don't think you have nearly the incidence of the little fire ant there as we do here. But one of the things we do hope to do in spearheading this effort to find the cause and the cure for this is to do a survey of the veterinarians throughout the state and find what their experience is. Here on the Big Island, it's like ground zero for these fire ants. They're everywhere, especially on the east side where it's moist. And that's where the problem is. It's affecting more than 50% of the animals in the Puna area, especially. And it goes all the way up the Hamakua coast past Hilo. So it's a big problem that needs to be addressed. And people, veterinarians aren't even sure of the diagnosis, and no treatment seems to work. They've tried antibiotics, they've tried antifungals, antivirals, anti-inflammatories, and nothing seems to work for this. So there needs to be a new approach and some research that goes into this.
We called several veterinarians, and they said exactly that. We don't really have much to offer. We can try to treat it the best that we can, but we really don't know enough. Given that fact, why haven't we seen a conclusive study up until this point, and what's it going to take to get one?
That's a very good question. I think part of the problem is because there's no solution, I don't think there's a lot of, well, actually, because the animals aren't in pain, which is the good news, they don't seem to be in pain with this eye condition. It makes it seem like it's not as significant. That combined with the fact that there's nothing you can do right now. So typically it's, the idea is to just tell people to get used to it. This is part of life in the tropics. But I don't think that's an acceptable answer. And I think, we need to try different alternatives. The problem is I don't want people to try just any remedy that they read on the internet or hear anecdotally that might work. And there's a lot of things that cause cloudying of the cornea. And we're talking about the cornea of the eye, the outer part of the eye, not like cataracts, which is the cloudying of the lens of the eye. This is the outer skin of the eye, so to speak. And this cloudying can spread. Interestingly, when you remove the animals from the tropics, it seems to get better. And when you bring them back to the tropics, it gets worse again. Going on. And the reason it's also controversial whether the ants are involved is because normally if you get a sting in the eye, you're going to have irritation, inflammation, itching, tearing, pain, and it gets better after a while, hopefully. But in this case, the animals seem to have no other inflammation in their eye. They just have this clouding of the cornea, and which can expand, and it doesn't go away, and it just lasts like the rest of their lives.
So, Sid, if this is the case, and there isn't anything that is an established treatment for this, what are you telling people to do, given the fact that you say that they shouldn't try anything that they simply see on the internet or that somebody may pass along to them anecdotally? In a way, you're passing on stuff anecdotally too, but do you have some sense of what is working with all the people that you know there, or what people are, in fact, trying with their animals?
Well, we don't know what's working. We have to approach this scientifically. And we're working with local vets on the Big Island to come up with some alternative treatments that are going to be safe. And it has to be documented and done scientifically. We're also working with some lab on the mainland. It's actually a world-famous veterinary ocular pathology laboratory associated with the University of Wisconsin that is going to help examine this situation and come up with a better diagnosis. We also have to get research into trying to find a pathogen which may be involved. It could be that the venom from the ant in the eye allows the introduction of a pathogen as a secondary infection, and it's a very slow infection. There are human eye conditions where they have an infection in the cornea that doesn't cause inflammation, and it just creates this type of a problem. So that might be the case. It also could be an immune reaction. So we're really we're in a total fog regarding the cause and treatment for this. So we need to fund research. I mean, what we're hoping to do is, involve local vets and the mainland vets in helping come up with an answer. And just allowing the community to realize that they're not alone in this plight, because it's really, even though the animal doesn't seem to be in pain, it's heartbreaking to, watch your animal lose its vision. And eye contact is such an important part of the human-animal bond.
So, Sid, as you're having this meeting tomorrow night to be able to draw together the community, what I'm hearing you say is this is really meant for the owners to be able to bond or to feel some sense of commiseration. But aside from knowing that maybe in the future, perhaps even the near future, that there'll be a study, there's not really a whole lot that can be offered.
That's true. I think the first thing is to even get acknowledgement that there's an epidemic going on here. We've tried. I've gotten contact, I have my website, Fire Ant Eye, about this, and I've gotten contacted by people moving to the Big Island, to the Puna area, which is actually the fastest growing part of the state. And they're bringing their pets, after jumping through all the hoops you have to jump through to bring your pet to Hawaii, and now they're worried that their pet's going to go blind or partially blind because of this condition. It's a serious problem that needs to first be acknowledged by, I think, some authority in Hawaii. We're getting vets are going to acknowledge it. They're going to put it on their website locally. But, you know, you talk to the Department of Agriculture, and they're concerned about livestock, not pets. And you talk to APHIS on the federal level, and they're concerned with the importation of diseases that might affect humans.
So who exactly, because we got to go in just a second, who exactly would satisfy you as being the authority to acknowledge that we have an epidemic?
I think it should be the Department of Agriculture. They have a page about importation of animals for, you know, bringing them into the state. So I think that would be a great place to warn people that, at least on the Big Island, on the east side of the Big Island, you have a very good chance that your animal can become blind if it comes here, partially blind.
Sid, we have to go for the moment, but we'll be watching this and hopefully looking forward to hearing that there will be a study soon underway. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Animal advocate Sid Singer is the director of the Good Shepherd Foundation. The community meeting that we referenced takes place tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at the Pahoa Community Center. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:15. Coming up, how you can add to your dog's existing skill set. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
We're taking a look at some issues surrounding Hawaii's pets in today's show. Hawaii is certainly a great place to be a pet owner with abundant opportunities for both animal and human to get outside and have fun together. On Oahu, one local pet owner took that idea a little farther than most. While heading to the beach for a surf session, a Waimanalo man decided to bring his pet pig along. And when it came time to get into the water, the 3-month-old pig could not be deterred from following his friend. It wasn't long before this water-loving creature was hanging 20, surfing alongside his owner on the same board. The image of a surfing pig caught both local and worldwide attention, and this iconic surf rider is named after a Hawaiian demigod. For today's quiz, we're looking for the name that both pig and god share. Make sure you have the full name and not just the abbreviation. And call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you have an answer for us. The first one to get it right gets to hang on to a HPR t-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from the Smithsonian Institution, presenting What Role Will Hawaii Play in the Pacific Century? With Admiral Harry B. Harris, Jr. and Irene Hirano Inoue, this Friday at 6 p.m. at the East-West Center. Learn more at whatitmeanstobeamerican.org.
Old dogs get a bum rap thanks to that old saw about their relationship to new tricks. Many dog lovers give up on their training too early, convinced that their companion animal just can't learn anymore. The members of Maui's Valley Isle Kennel Club believe that most dogs at just about any age are capable of learning a variety of complex tasks. They put the skills of both dogs and handlers to the test in twice-yearly dog rallies. They've got one coming up at the end of the month, and Angie Federici president of the Valley Isle Kennel Club, told us about it.
The Valley Isle Kennel Club has been on Maui for 30 years. This is actually our 30th anniversary year. And Rally is an event that we have twice a year, usually sometime in November as well as in April. And it's a really fun activity with the dogs. We learn to work together as a team, and the dog and the handler focus on each other. There's a series of tasks that we do. There's about 35 different tasks, and each judge sets up a course with about between 12 and 15 of those tasks. So our competition is going to be on October 30th, mm-hmm. and we've had classes every week on Sundays at 4 o'clock at the Eddie Tam Park.
And those classes are geared toward learning how to do those tasks?
Correct. It's practice time for the handlers to learn the signs and for the dogs to learn the behaviors, and it's really a lot of fun.
What are some of the tasks?
Oh, there's different things. Like, for example, there's one sign where the dog has to, as you're walking, the dog has to lay down and stay down while you walk around the dog, which can be very challenging because every time I do it, my dog tries to turn around and follow me.
Yeah.
Which he's not supposed to do.
Yeah.
Other things like taking a series of steps backwards and sitting after each time and pausing and sitting, which can be challenging when the dog just wants to run and play.
Mm-hmm.
Different turning and different types of footwork. Lots of different things.
Well, we've all experienced dogs that just don't seem to listen, right?
Yes.
Does a dog reach a point where it's past being trainable, where it's just, been set in its ways for too long?
I don't believe so. You can teach an old dog new tricks.
Good.
not every training method works with every dog. You have to be able to try different techniques. We mm-hmm. also offer an obedience class as well as Rally, and we also have agility classes. And all of those work on developing the bond between the human and the dog.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very rewarding for both.
Well, Angie, I talked to a horse trainer earlier this morning, in fact, and she was saying that with horses, training has moved in a much kinder, gentler direction than it used to. Has it been that way with dogs as well?
Yes, I believe so. There's a lot of force-free training methods and very positive methods, rewards, using treats as rewards. There's no punishment. It's all positive
mm-hmm.
and encouraging, and it gets the dog to motivate to work for you. The dog wants to do what you're asking them to do because it's fun and rewarding, and they get a treat.
So they don't get spoiled then?
Sometimes they might get a little spoiled, but no, they get a reward for their good behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have fun and enjoy it.
So you can use rewards and not use punishment and get a good result.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what our classes are. That's what we practice. And then when we're in the ring for competition, we don't get to use rewards. They just have to do it from memory. But by the time we've practiced so frequently, the dogs know and they perform without getting a treat. The reward is doing a good job and mm-hmm. having fun.
How many of these training sessions, Angie, do you think a dog needs to really be able to perform well in something like this dog rally?
Last year, I started about a month before the competition, and my dog was able to compete successfully in both aspects, both trials that we had, and ended up getting his novice title. So really anywhere from, 3 to 5 weeks of classes with practice is plenty of time for novice level. Of course, if you go to the higher levels, you need much more practice than that. But the beginning level, pretty basic.
That's just things like lie down, stay, simple commands?
Yeah, simple commands, basic commands, and as well as some of those signs that we mentioned earlier.
What are some of the more advanced skills in the higher levels?
It's just a lot more complicated, some of the more complicated signs and footwork and doing the competition off leash. For the novice level, you're working with your dog together on a leash.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at the higher levels, the dog is off leash and has to stay, within an appropriate distance of you and not take off or run out of the ring or get distracted, things like that. So really being able to pay attention and focus on the handler.
You know, we've all seen well-trained dogs who get in the company of a lot of other dogs, and the training kind of goes out the window, can't it?
That can happen, but all of our dogs usually are pretty well-behaved. And they learn to work through those distractions and really focus and pay attention. So,
what kind of dog do you have, Angie?
Well, I have three dogs, and they're all mutts. I have two that are Yorkshire Terrier and Poodle mixes, and one of them is actually a therapy dog. So we do visits at different places on Maui, assisted living facilities and things like that. And I also have another dog that's a rescue, and I got her from HARF, Hawaii Animal Rescue Foundation, and she's some kind of a terrier mix, maybe Jack Russell and something else. She's one of those very energetic and very enthusiastic dogs.
Can you tell?
That brings up a good point about the Kennel Club. The Kennel Club is not just for purebred dogs with papers. Any dogs can participate as long as they sign up and register.
Are some breeds easier to train than others?
I don't necessarily know that there are some breeds that are easier to train than others, but there are definitely breeds that are better suited to certain personality types of owners and handlers. You know, depending on things like size and energy level and temperament and what the person wants to do with their dog. You know, my dogs love to swim and run and play and go to the beach. So they're very active, so they would be better suited for somebody who has a lot of energy. There are other dogs that are more suited to kind of lay around and hang out and watch movies with you, you know, if they're a lower energy dog.
Angie Federici is the president of the Valley Isle Kennel Club, which is holding American Kennel Club Obedience and Rally Trials Sunday, October 30th from 8:30 to 6 p.m. at the Eddie Tam Horse Arena in Makawao. Entries are due on October 12th, and you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Just me and my dog strolling around. Just me and my dog strolling around. Wait for the sky to swell with white to wash away all our pain.
To sustain, to provide what's needed for something to exist or continue. That's exactly what HPR Sustaining members do. They know their monthly gifts mean a steady, predictable income for the station and that we couldn't survive without them. Sustainers are a big part of the reason HPR comes to everyone every day. So please help your public radio station continue to thrive by pledging $10 or more a month. You can call us at 955-8821 or become a sustaining member at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. People hooked on painkillers and the doctors who treat them had a short-lived scare recently. The director of the Drug Enforcement Division had planned to enforce a law barring a drug used to counter opioid addiction. The Attorney General, though, had a different idea. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethany.
So clearly the idea of not being able to use a drug that is effective in treating opioid addiction sent a shudder through the drug treatment community. Why did the Narcotics Enforcement Division want to bar the prescriptions?
Well, they believe that the law gave them permission to do so until Attorney General Doug Chin said no, although there are some ambiguities in the law. We're talking specifically about prescribing what's known as a Suboxone, and that's used to treat addiction to opioids, which, of course, are very powerful painkillers, and it's a serious crisis nationwide. Well, you can now, again, prescribe those Suboxones, but too few doctors are really willing to prescribe the drug, even though it's hailed as a lifesaver for addicts. There's a concern that the legal dust-up, if you will, between the Narcotics Enforcement Division and the AG may confuse people further, make them reluctant, doctors in particular, to prescribe this medicine.
Why did this all come up, though, if so few doctors are using it and there are so many ambiguities around it? Why did the Drug Enforcement Division feel that they had to take this on now?
Well, in fact, its purpose is enforcing narcotics. And so there was a feeling that the law gave them permission to do that. And let me throw out some statistics that raise a lot of concerns. Nationally, overdosing from opioids has actually reached a record high. It did in 2014. But, you know, only about 2-3% of doctors actually obtain the Drug Enforcement Agency approval to be able to prescribe these drugs. In Hawaii, it's probably even less than 2% of that. But the real concern here and the reality check is that only 1 in 10 addicts actually gets the needed treatment, and that's why this is so important to understand. I can't explain too much further why the Narcotics Enforcement Division, which is part of public safety, decided to push this so strong, but some doctors are saying, let's now hail the AG's ruling on this as a way to try and clear up the misunderstanding about these drugs, about treating people that are addicted to opioids, and hopefully get people the help that they need.
There's been such a movement behind this, both locally and nationally, naloxone, other drugs that have been used to treat opioid addiction. And as you say, so few treatments that have been truly effective and so few people getting those treatments. At this point, is there anything more to be said about this, or that doctors are pretty much free to do it and take advantage of it?
A lot more work to be done. Insurance companies, for example, have barriers to getting people on this. The Affordable Care Act doesn't seem to treat substance abuse quite at the same parity as other medical problems. Then there's the population itself, the people that are addicted to this. They're worried about these pills getting out on the black market and street use. So there's a whole lot of work that's needed to reform how we treat people that are addicted to opioids.
And really quickly, what about with Medicare?
Well, that's another problem as well, whether it can cover it or not. And you can read John Hill's story. It's quite detailed and up on our website, a really big eye-opener into the world of opioid prescriptions.
All right, Chad, we're going to leave it there. Thanks so much. Talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat. Every day he joins us with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
In most election years, the debate between vice presidential candidates is just part of the campaign staging. Sure, there have been one-line zingers in the past, from current Vice President Joe Biden calling then-Congressman Paul Ryan's answer a bunch of malarkey in 2012, to over 30 years ago when then-Senator Lloyd Benson looked at Dan Quayle and said he was no Jack Kennedy. But tonight, when Virginia Senator Tim Kaine and Indiana Governor Mike Pence go at it, there could be much more at stake. Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us now with a preview. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Good to talk to you. Now, before we get into the thing about the VP debate, I want to talk to you a little bit about what we've seen in the week since we talked last time. Because since that time, we've seen attacks on a Miss Universe. We've heard a lot about Mr. Trump's taxes, which he says he was smart enough to legally avoid. And lately, even a suggestion that it's Mrs. Clinton who had been unfaithful. Are we in for more tabloid politics? Are we ever really going to get any substantive issues?
Well, if you want substantive issues, you probably want that Pence-Kaine debate tonight, because otherwise you'll see in the debates, as we saw in the first debate last Monday, as we'll see in the next debate October 9th, there's a lot of personal invective going back and forth between Trump and Clinton with less than 5 weeks to go. No, actually 5 weeks to go today. Before the election, it's hard to imagine these two candidates suddenly, taking off the gloves and sounding like statespersons.
So really, truly, if you want to get to the issues, it's going to be tonight, which is seemingly to say that this is a real departure from the way vice presidential debates have been regarded in past.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, look, aside from Lyndon Johnson in 1960, it's hard to make the case that any vice president has any vice presidential candidate has made a difference one way or the other for the presidential ticket. Remember how much Dan Quayle was mocked, as you point out, by Lloyd Benson saying you're no Jack Kennedy, and Dan Quayle standing there like proverbial deer in the headlights. But ultimately, when all was said and done in 1988, the Bush-Quayle ticket won 40 out of 50 states. We think of Geraldine Ferraro in 1984 talking to George H.W. Bush about, don't you dare patronize me. And basically, it looked like Ferraro got the better of it. And Mondale Ferraro lost 49 out of 50 states that year. So you could have memorable moments in vice presidential debates that ultimately, especially in 2016, when you have such people like Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, it really is all about the top of the ticket.
So tonight, what are we looking for? I mean, if there's, you know, a little bit more pressure on them to perform or to at least represent their parties well, what should we be watching for?
Well, I think both sides will probably point out that the fact that there is some daylight between Pence and Trump on certain issues. Mike Pence has released his taxes. Mike Pence has criticized going after the Khan family, the Muslim family that lost a son in war, American soldier in war. There is some daylight between the two of them. And, of course, Tim Kaine may not be as liberal as the party seems to have been moving on issues like abortion, although he is heading in that direction. There is some daylight between the two candidates. But, look, in all honesty, Donald Trump, I mean, if you just look at the actuarial tables alone, Donald Trump is 70 years old. He'd be the oldest person ever elected president. Hillary Clinton is 68. After Ronald Reagan, she's the second oldest if she were elected. And so you do want to look at Mike Pence and Tim Kaine as potential presidents down the line. And plus the fact these are two serious people. They may be not Mr. Excitement, but they are very substantial regarding their philosophy and the issues. And so if you want to, you know, rather than read a copy of Foreign Affairs magazine, you may want to listen to the debate tonight. And of course, hopefully, if you're a political junkie, look for a little gaffe that'll make you smile. But there are important things here that they're going to discuss.
Important things, but you also brought up, you know, the issue of temperaments and also certainly the fact of age. Are we really in a situation where in some ways these two may help to define or shape this political campaign?
I just don't think so. I just can't think of anybody who's going to watch Mike Pence tonight and like him or dislike him, and that'll be the decision on whether one votes for Donald Trump or not. I mean, the fact is that Mike Pence is a true blue conservative on many issues, on abortion, on same-sex marriage, his famous signing of the Religious Freedom Bill in Indiana that basically denied services to gay and lesbians by business owners for religious purposes, which was, of course, later walked back. But, I mean, he really believes that stuff. Donald Trump is not an ideologue. He's been on all sides of every issue for most of his career. But if you want somebody who really wants to talk about serious politics, Tim Kaine, of course, both men have had their faith. Tim Kaine is a Catholic. Mike Pence is a former Catholic, now evangelical. Faith is very important to both their campaigns. Issues are very important. And comity is very important, too. Whatever you think about Pence or Kaine, both of them are nice guys. And, of course, we're not used to nice guys having watched the campaign for the past year and a half.
And they seem to be absolute foils for the presidential candidates.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, nobody will confuse Mike Pence with Donald Trump. Tim Kaine and Hillary Clinton are much more closer in temperament. But if you look at poll, you don't have to get me to remind you that both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton have unusually high unfavorable numbers, whatever you think of the two candidates. And that's not the case about Pence and Kaine, probably because nobody knows who they are. Probably, too, because the giant personalities of Clinton and Trump have dominated this campaign. But we'll see what happens tonight. And look, you know, this will be the most important thing on October 4th. And then on October 5th, we'll move on to something else.
Okay. I mean, all that said, given the fact that they have these giant personalities looming over them, do you think that they'll have to do any sort of, you know, defense of some of the things that we've seen over the last week?
No, I mean, I think there may be more pressure on Pence because there's a larger percentage of Republicans who are still not sure about the top of the ticket than there are about Democrats. Even though there was some wariness among the Bernie Sanders people about Hillary Clinton, for the most part, there are a lot of establishment Republicans, the John Kasichs of the world, the Mitt Romneys, the Bushes of the world, who are just not comfortable with Trump. Pence could certainly try to make the case for Donald Trump. I'm just not sure that any minds get changed tonight.
All right. Well, we don't have long to see. It's going to be 3 o'clock our time out here, 9 o'clock yours, and then we'll have more to talk about next week, and we can take a look at what's going on with the Senate too. Thanks a whole lot for this morning.
Thanks. I enjoyed it a lot. Thank you.
Talk to you next week. Ken Rudin is one of America's foremost experts in politics and campaign history. He focuses on presidential elections, the races for the House and Senate, and state governors. He also hosts the weekly Political Junkie program and is a contributor to many national public radio programs, including to ours over the next couple of weeks.
Hi, good morning. I'm James Foster from the University of Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of.
It's just something that you
wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. As we go through life, we hear many cliches. Another day, another dollar. Easy as pie. It's better to give than to receive. In the case of Bobby Fujimoto and his family, that last one has proven to be true time and again. He was president of Hawaii Planning Mill for 38 years. There's more than meets the eye at HPM, for it was one of the first businesses in the state to offer profit sharing to its employees. This decision was a no-brainer. Today, the employees own 100% of the company. The family began the HPM Foundation, which offers scholarships to college students and grants to support community groups, and have found they get back more than they give. Bobby's daughter, Roberta Chu, continues the family's legacy by giving much to the Hawaii Community Foundation, not just gifts of treasure, of course, because money can't buy everything. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing that for 100 years, philanthropy is all about you.
And now we'll get back to the backyard quiz for today. We asked you for the full name of a local legend, Hawaii's surfing pig. He was born to a Waimanalo family who discovered his affinity for the water soon after his birth. In a few short months, he was not only swimming, but surfing alongside his owner. The two became such a common sight at Oahu's sandy beach that the four-legged surfer was made its unofficial mascot. The pig shares his name with a Hawaiian demigod who was renowned as the most handsome man in the land. In fact, he was so handsome that his mistress was the hottest woman on earth, Madame Pele. The name of this demigod derives from the two animal forms he could take. On land, he could change into a pig, and in the water, he became the Humuhumu Nuku Nuku Apu'a'a, Hawaii state fish. The name of that demigod was Kamapua'a, who lent it to our modern-day four-legged surfing prodigy, commonly known as Kama. You can see the porcine surfing video of Kama and his son Kamatu on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
And Beth Ann, Sherry Guillermo of Kona knew the answer. Congratulations, Sherry, and she wins an HPR T-shirt. And if you've got a quiz for us, send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Here comes, come on, come on, you the king. Come on, come on, come on, the surfing bee.
Oh, check that out.
Jive, look at that.
Oh, how's that bee? The Sandy's mascot. Polynesian pua. Charging on a
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii Private Banking, where a personal relationship manager and financial services team provide custom solutions. Learn more about Bank of Hawaii Private Banking at boh.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Few countries have done as much damage to each other as the U.S. and Vietnam, but the years since that conflict have seen a remarkable connection between the two countries. For 8 years now, a conference called Engaging with Vietnam Through Scholarship and the Arts has built on that connection and urged academics and artists to make most of the concerns of they have in common. Liam Kelly is an associate professor of history at the University of Hawaii at Manoa and a co-founder of the conference, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Liam.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
When the Vietnam War got underway, most Americans had no idea where it was, what it was, anything about the country, right?
Right, sure.
What do, I mean, obviously the conflict changed all that, but to what do you attribute the post-war interest that Americans have had in Vietnam?
Well, there are a couple things. First of all, Vietnam started to open up to the world starting in 1986, and a generation of which I'm a part became interested in Vietnam at that point. Then you also have the descendants of Vietnamese who immigrated or left as refugees in 75 who have all come of age.
Mm-hmm.
But now you also have lots of Vietnamese who are studying overseas, who are contributing to an international world of scholarship. And actually the real founder of this conference is my colleague at UH, Phan Le Ha, who founded it when she was in Australia. But she is from Vietnam. She got her PhD in Australia and then started this conference series. So this all is kind of showing this mix of people who are interested in Vietnam now.
And prior to the 80s, there really wasn't a significant worldwide community of Vietnamese people, right?
Right. I mean, you're speaking of the diaspora.
Yeah.
Right. No, that's all since 75, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's obviously changed their culture and the culture of places where they've settled, right?
Exactly, because a lot of overseas Vietnamese have returned. But now with the kind of development of Vietnam, there are many Vietnamese from Vietnam who have gone overseas to study and are working. And so the global Vietnamese community today is really complex.
Pre-Vietnam War Vietnam, which was actually two countries, right?
Mm-hmm.
The North Vietnam didn't have much, if any, interest in engaging with the West, or did it?
No, I mean, not the our West. It was part of the Soviet bloc and had very close connections with the Soviet Union and other countries, mm-hmm. even places like Cuba. But again, it's only since the late 80s and that it's really started to engage with the world.
Yeah, it wasn't really a nation that saw itself as having a global reach. Was that fueled by necessity to some degree?
Yeah, I mean, the original opening up of the country in 86 was at a time when the Soviet Union was in decline. It basically paralleled perestroika or the renovation in mm-hmm. the Soviet Union. So that started as necessity. But now I think, Vietnam and Vietnamese just want to be equal players in the world. And so it's driven more by ambition than anything else, I would say.
This started as an academic conference, but now it has included artists this time in the eighth year. What's the rationale for that?
Right. The conference, actually this year it's called Engaging with Vietnam Through Scholarship and the Arts. The continuous title is Engaging with Vietnam and Interdisciplinary Dialogue. So it has always been a multidisciplinary conference. But in the past couple of years in traveling to Vietnam, some artists have reached out to me, and I've realized that there's a lot in common in the questions we ask about, say, Vietnamese society, and that led Phan Le Ha and myself to decide to make a theme for this year's conference of engaging with Vietnam through scholarship and the arts. And so although it's always been multidisciplinary, this year it is really bringing out more people from the music and art world.
Well, the arts are always seen as an excellent window into a society and a culture. But today's Vietnamese artists do operate under some restrictions, right?
Yeah, that's for sure. But at the same time, they really are the ones who, I guess, push the boundaries of those restrictions. And that's what we'll be talking a lot about at this conference, is seeing the kinds of work that people do. It's not really overtly political, but in a world where you are restricted in what you can say, just certain forms of self-expression themselves can become political.
You've certainly seen, you know, in the art of the communist world in past, art that was very much constrained by the government. And you wonder how much art there can be without artistic freedom.
Right. Well, you know, that was certainly the case in Vietnam. Then in the 80s, as the first foreigners started to go there again, there was this discovery of art that had existed there, and the art world in Vietnam really took off. But the contemporary artists today, I think, are doing, they're a part of a younger generation, and they've are a lot more connected to the outside world, and they're just doing new things that the Vietnamese art world hasn't seen before.
Fair to say that no Vietnamese artist of any age is unaffected by the past conflict, even if they was born long after, right?
That's an interesting question. You know, today the population of Vietnam, I can't remember the percentage, but a huge percentage is under 30 years old. And so, yes, of course, everyone would have to be affected some way. But most kids today who are under 30 grew up in without hardship. They've got an iPhone like everyone else. And that would be an interesting study to see to what extent they are affected.
Well, especially for you as a historian, because, you know, historians know how the past affects the present and the future, right?
Yeah. But, you know, I'm just thinking of some of the artists whose work will be discussed. They're really more interested in contemporary issues, and I don't see much of the war in their work. But obviously on a larger level, that it's always there.
Sure. I mean, how could you not have a family member or someone
exactly
in a past generation mm-hmm. affected? But that is interesting to see how much artists can leave the past behind, isn't it?
Sure. But I think a lot of artists today are just, there are issues that they're dealing with of self-expression and of wanting to, say, question orthodox views of society and the past. And, a lot of those ideas were developed during wartime. So in a sense, there's that effect on things. But they're just really focused on the present.
That I find that fascinating, just given the weight of history in that particular
right.
country.
Mm.
But yet, and I also wonder, you know, it almost seems to me that so many artists will tell you that it's almost a responsibility to be revolutionary, to be challenging.
In a place like Vietnam, I think there's so much incentive today to get a job where you can become rich and you see all the people around you doing that. So artists who take a different path, they're already revolutionaries in one form. And so just through their lives, they're expressing things that are different from society as a whole, but that say things about society.
Well, it's obviously this conference is an opportunity to learn a great deal more. So thanks very much for coming in and
sure.
telling us about it.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. Liam Kelly is a professor of history, an associate professor of history at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, and a co-founder and conference co-chair of Engaging with Vietnam Through Scholarship in the Arts, a conference at the university. A couple events related to the conference are free and open to the public, a screening of clips from the Queer Vietnamese Film Festival, at Moore Hall on Wednesday at 2 p.m., and a concert by Vietnamese musician No Hong Quang at Orvis Auditorium, 7:30 on Thursday. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Bình minh đến suốt tan đêm dài, sao lòng em còn nhớ anh
nhớ hoài.
Anh, vì đôi lúc anh hay nghi ngờ, để cho trái tim em thẫn thờ, phải làm sao để anh mãi yêu em. Từng giận hờn anh yêu nhé, trái tim đã thuộc về nhau, ngọt ngào tình yêu lên tiếng, khẽ kêu riêng anh.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a fall open house where parents can learn more about the school's educational experience, Sunday, November 20th at 2:30, sacredhearts.org.
Beth Ann, I wonder how many prospective voters out there know who the vice presidential candidates are for the two different parties.
Well, and given the personality of those two, that may not be a difficult question to answer. But the bottom line, and as Ken Rudin said, is it may be the best thing going for today on the air and to be able to pay attention to. And then tomorrow will come and life will move on. And really, will this matter? A lot of people put more attention on this because of, you know, who's running for president. But we'll see whether it really adds to the mix or just gives us another memorable one-liner.
Yeah, these are the less charismatic member of each team.
Yeah, exactly. But they may, in fact, end up talking more substantively. That'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
That's later today, 3 o'clock, right here on HPR2. Now, this week, the Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofit Organizations is holding its annual conference. We'll speak with Rich Harwood of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation in Bethesda, Maryland, coming here to Keynote. He'll be talking about turning outward to engage communities through service. We'll find out exactly what that means.
And a weekend circus camp takes an anti-gravity approach to yoga.
Meanwhile, we always like to hear from you. We really do. You can call our talkback line at 792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want a pass one, you can find them under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation. See you then.
Hi, this is Todd Zwillick from The Takeaway. You know what cable news post-debate analysis doesn't have? You. We're capping off each night with Debate Rewind. It's a live call-in special from The Takeaway. This is your show and your chance to be heard after the debate. So call us at 1-800-543-2543 to weigh in.
This afternoon at 5.